Good evening. Very good to be with all of you again. Make sure this is on. All right, we're good. There are some of you that I haven't seen for 4 years and 3 months. That's how long our family have been up in Kentucky. And it's really good to reconnect with some of you. Really good to start to get to know the church here. I've really appreciated the conversations, the meals that I've had with you guys. Been very, very encouraging. And this series of lessons, when I first moved to Atlanta, I was coming from a church in California where I was asked to do all the preaching and teaching and all the counseling and therapy and everything, and I was worn out. And one of the things that was told to me when I moved to Atlanta is you don't have to do everything. And there's certain things that if you want to learn and kind of grow yourself in certain areas, you're going to have the bandwidth to be able to do that. And these lessons are the fruit of that time in my life, and these things have permanently affected the way that I talk with non-Christians and talk with Christians. My hope with these lessons is not just that we have some more equipment to know how to deal with people who are secular. And by let me say this about that. I'm not trying to say that this is some kind of magic bullet that's going to make anytime you talk to a secular person, become a Christian. Most of the world is still going to reject the truth. But if we have more tools where we know how to navigate conversations and situations, that might help us have some tactical advantage in those conversations. But my hope is not only that these lessons are going to help us know how to navigate some of the changing world around us, but also it's going to challenge us. Do you suppose Christians sometimes need to be challenged on where we are actually finding our meaning in life? What we're going to do in this lesson is I'm going to walk you through how I talked about these things with skeptics while I lived in Atlanta, and how I still do this where I live in Bowling Green. And I'll let you know this at the beginning. We're going to look at several quotes from atheists. And the point of looking at those quotes is not for you all to start memorizing quotes from skeptics. I'm wanting us to understand how they think through these things so that we feel more confident when we're having conversations. And tomorrow morning, we're going to talk about certain kinds of questions you can ask people without needing to know these quotes, but these quotes are going to help deepen our understanding of what we're talking about. We talked last night about some of the causes of unbelief. That the modern skeptic would like to present themselves as people that are very rational and they've been educated, and if you still believe in God or the Bible or religion, that you have some kind of emotional reason for needing to believe that there is an afterlife and all that. But we talked last night about some of the causes of unbelief being emotional. That somebody might want to present themselves as very intellectual and academic, but oftentimes reasons for unbelief stem from a desire to sin, but wanting to justify yourself. Sometimes it stems from having a bad religious experience and you want to be done with the whole thing. And sometimes it deals with the choice of people that that are in your sphere of influence, and you want to fit in with those people or with society at large. So in other words, a big reason for unbelief is emotional in nature. So what if, whenever we're dealing with people that are skeptics, we just give them a bunch of logical arguments for why they should believe in God, archaeological evidence, logical arguments to believe in the existence of God, when they're actually unbelievers because of emotional things? Did Jesus ever appeal to people based on emotional things that could pull them closer to him? We looked at a passage yesterday like this, but John, here's another one. John's gospel does this the most, where Jesus says at the last day of the Feast of Booths, "If anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink." Well, why would somebody thirst? We've got deep longings like a need for meaning and a need for identity and a need for hope and all these other needs that we could think of. And if you're trying to drink from wells that have dried out, you're thirsting. And Jesus would call to people and say, look within yourself at the things that you know are lacking, and then look to me and know that I'm the one who can provide that for you. And so tonight we're going to talk about our need for meaning. I don't know if any of you have heard about Viktor Frankl, But in World War II, he was a Jewish psychoanalyst in a concentration camp. And he developed something called logotherapy or logotherapy. And the idea was, if I can help people instill a meaning of life, that they'll be able to withstand lots of trials and difficulties. And he says this in his book, Man's Search for Meaning. Logotherapy, I don't know how to pronounce that, regards its assignment as that of assisting the patient to find meaning in his life. And so while he was working as a Jewish psychoanalyst in the concentration camps, he was also a prisoner, but he was still working as a Jewish psychoanalyst because that's just what he did. He found that the people that had strength to endure the trials the best were people who did have a sense of meaning in their life. What does it mean to have meaning in your life? I think it means largely that you can look back to your origins and be able to answer, why am I here? What's the point of my existence? And if you were to talk to a skeptic and ask them, all right, what is your sense of meaning in life? I'm going to show you some quotes that I use when I talk to skeptics, and I'll let you know that the skeptics I study with like the quotes that I'm showing you. One of them is from an atheist named Fabian Suchinek, and he says this: the purpose of life must be the intention that the creator of life pursued with his creation. Now, unfortunately, there is no such creator in the atheist worldview. Thus, the notion of purpose of life in the sense of the intention of a creator is undefined in the atheist world. For atheists, there is no God-given purpose of life. This is not anything that they have a hard time saying, yeah, I agree with that. If there's no God outside of me that's told me and creation what our life ought to look like, then there's a very real sense in which there is no objective meaning to life. Now, do you think that they would just stop there and go, that's right, life is meaningless? Or do you think they would say, yeah, there's no objective meaning to my life assigned by a God because I don't believe in one to begin with, but there's still ways in which we try to figure out a meaning in life? And I like this quote where this guy explains how he derives his meaning in life. This is a famous podcaster named Adam Rutherford, and he says, a meaningless universe does not mean we live our lives without purpose. I'm an atheist, but I try to live my life replete with purpose. Be kind, learn, and discover as much as you can. Share that knowledge, relieve suffering when you can. Have tonnes of fun. He's British, that's how they spell tons. Have tonnes of fun, that's why it's not pointless. We have the power to create life and to show those lives wonder. Surely that's enough. It is for me. Try to think about the things that he's saying here. There's no God that's told me what to do, but I sure do like being kind. You know, have you ever done that thing before where you're in the Starbucks line and you go ahead and just pay for that person behind you because you just want to be nice and it just makes you feel so good to do something like that? Doesn't that feel good to be kind to people? That's cool. What's the next one? Learn and discover as much as you can. Isn't it fun to read books and listen to podcasts and feel enlightened about things and all the crimes that happen at parks? That's a famous kind of podcast, I guess. So it's kind of fun to share like what psycho killers do. And then you share that knowledge. So you that. And then how about relieving suffering? There's people that have emotional problems in life. Isn't it nice to help those people? People got financial problems. Isn't it nice to help people like that? And then, I mean, who doesn't like having tonnes of fun? I mean, I like having fun, don't you guys? So do you see that this would be a modern skeptic in at least America, at Great Britain, where this guy's from? Do you see that a lot of these things in this quote are not inherently wrong? A lot of these things are not inherently wrong. But let me ask the question, and this is part of where these lessons ought to also challenge Christians. Do you look at that, and do you feel like you identify a lot with that? Or do you see any problems with this? If your life is supposed to be dedicated to Christ, but this is what you can identify as being like your purpose in life, and there's nothing about God said in this, do you see that you might have some secular ideas creeping into your own heart? What are some problems with this secular approach to trying to find meaning in life? There's several things that we can think about for this. Maybe the first thing that we could say about this is that this worldview cannot apply to everybody in the world. If you have a worldview that literally can't apply to most people in the world, it's probably not a very good worldview. Because let's think about these questions. Can everyone learn, discover, and share? Do you think that everybody in the world can do that? Maybe to some extent. How about this one? Can everybody relieve suffering? Can everybody have tones of fun? I remember one time there was a preacher that had spent some time in India, and he had told me, he had this vivid story of a guy that had no arms and no legs, and people would carry this guy to the street corner and like fold out a blanket so that people could drop money for him. Can you imagine going up to that guy and saying, you know, look, I don't know what your view is of God and the afterlife, but I just want you to be more better informed that there is no God. And really, I know that, you know, you seem to be praying a lot down here, but I think really what you need to be thinking about is learning, discovering, and sharing things, and relieve suffering when you have those opportunities. And then you need to start having more fun in life. Would you ever say that? Do you know what kind of people can say, oh yeah, this is my meaning in life? People who live in privileged parts of the world. And so this can't apply to most people. Now, that's the first problem. There's a second problem with this worldview, and that is that it's vexing to think about. Those moments when you think deeply about what's my reason for living, why am I here to begin with, if your core answer is still that there's no ultimate meaning, so I discover what meaning is for my own life, wouldn't that be vexing and sort of annoying to think about? Leo Tolstoy was a famous Russian author. And he wrote War and Peace, and he wrote lots of other different kinds of literature as well. But he was a very wealthy and healthy. He writes about how healthy he was even in his mid-50s. And he wrote a book called Confessions, or A Confession. And it's where he documents how he came from a secular worldview to more of a Bible-focused worldview. And I don't know where he landed on all the doctrinal things about how to be saved, but he got to a point where he believed in the Scriptures. And he says this in the book. I could give no reasonable meaning to any single action or to my whole life. Sooner or later, my affairs, whatever they may be, will be forgotten, and I shall not exist. Then why go on making any effort? How can man fail to see this, and how go on living? That is what is surprising. One can only live while one is intoxicated with life. As soon as one is sober, it is impossible not to see that it is all a mere fraud and a stupid fraud. That is precisely what it is. There is nothing either amusing or witty about it. It is simply cruel and stupid. Notice that Leo Tolstoy says that he couldn't give any answer to any single action that he did or even to his whole life. Why am I brushing my teeth right now? Why am I planting this garden in the backyard? Why am I going to this restaurant right now? What, like, and even my whole existence, why am I even here? And whenever he would think about these things, he would get into this depressive kind of state. Why go on making any efforts? And he says here, one can only live while one is intoxicated with life. What do you think he means by that? He doesn't mean here literally being drunk all the time. What he's saying here is, long as I can amuse myself and not think deeply about anything, I can just have my meaning in life derived from having tons of fun and kind of being popular and all these different sorts of things. As long as I don't think deeply, I'll be okay. Have you ever thought about the word amusement and what that means? What does it mean to muse, M-U-S-E, to think deeply? What does the letter A in front of a word mean? Like without. To amuse yourself is to not think deeply. Do you think in our world that that's a problem? Endless videos of cats flushing toilets online. Videos of gorillas doing gorilla things and people making sheds out in the wood with like three pieces of equipment or something that ever they had. And we just watch all this stuff and we're not forced to think deeply about anything. Do you think artificial intelligence is going to make people not think as deeply as well if they're not careful about how to use these kinds of things? One can live while one is intoxicated with life. As long as you keep amusing yourself with TV shows and YouTube videos that make no difference about anything, you don't have to think about any of this. Now, this is interesting. Let me say something else about how this is vexing to think about. If you talk with skeptics, it's ironic because they'll say, yeah, I'm Spock and I think very deeply about things, and that's why I'm not a Christian. But then they'll also be candid and they say, well, it is pretty depressing to think about meaning in life in our worldview. Let me show you something that one atheist named Will Storr says. He wrote this book called The Science of Storytelling, and this is like the first paragraph of the book. We know how this ends. You're going to die, and so will everyone you love. Human life, in all its noise and hubris, will be rendered meaningless for eternity. The cure for the horror is story. Our brains distract us from this terrible truth by filling our lives with hopeful goals and encouraging us to strive for them. It gives our existence the illusion of meaning and turns our gaze from the dread. Isn't that a great introduction? Don't you want to read the rest of that book now? So that's why it's important to know story. Like Lord of the Rings, that's cool. Harry Potter, that's cool. Knowing how to tell your own stories to your grandkids, that'll make you interesting. And so the best that we can do is distract ourselves and give ourselves the illusion that there's meaning in life. If you know people that are secular-minded, their own people will say the best we can do is distract ourselves. Now, going back to Viktor Frankl, Viktor Frankl had this to say about this meaningless existence that people struggle with. The drug scene is one aspect of a more general mass phenomenon, namely the feeling of meaninglessness resulting from a frustration of our existential needs. Why do you think people use drugs? Why do you think people literally intoxicate themselves? To dull themselves. So they don't have to deal with the fact that in their worldview, there's no reason for my existence. Have you found more and more people recently talking about how the life on earth just feels meaningless? It almost feels like there's like a social consciousness where there's more and more people not caring about things because they're feeling more and more detached. What kind of worldview says this? There's no meaning in life. The best you can have is the illusion of meaning. And so entertain yourself with stories. You want that to be your worldview? Now somebody might say, well, I can get along fine entertaining myself with all these things and just amusing myself to death, but there's still a problem with this worldview, even if you want to be more of a shallow thinker. And the problem is that suffering is eventually going to come. There are things that if you build your meaning in life in this life, suffering and trials and difficulties will strip you away from those things. I want to show you something that Bertrand Russell, an atheist, said about this. Look at this quote from Bertrand Russell. For the young, there is nothing unattainable. A good thing desired with the whole force of a passionate will, and yet impossible, is to them not credible. Yet by death, by illness, by poverty, or by the voice of duty, we must learn, each one of us, that the world was not made for us, and that however beautiful may be the things we crave, fate may nevertheless forbid them. What's the belief of young people here? All right, there's a lot of young people here. You guys, according to Bertrand Russell, think that you got your future ahead of you. And if you want to get a Corvette one day, you'll get one. I want a Cybertruck still. I saw one pass me by when I got to the building here. I was like, what is a good day? There's certain things that you think that you might be able to attain, but there's going to be things like fate or trials that are going to burst your bubble. Think about the things that make it so your meaning in life or the things you wanted to build in your life get stripped from you. Death. Now, that might be your death, but it could also be the death of other people that meant a lot to you. So I've got a wife and four kids. What if my whole meaning in life was built around my wife and children? Like, that's all that mattered to me. And if I wasn't with them, and Samantha was driving the car somewhere and got in a tragic car accident, and they all died in one moment, what would that do to my meaning in life? Would it be hard? Absolutely. But for the Christian, we're going to talk about the Christian's meaning in life in just a moment, death is not going to take you away from your meaning in life. Well, notice the next one, illness. There was one time when I was preaching at this little church in Minnesota while I was getting my college education. And there was an older guy in that town who came up to me one day, and these are his words, not mine. He came up to me and said, "Hey, Eric, do you want to know why there's so many old, cranky people in the world?" And I was like, "Yeah, I want to know that, because I don't want to be one of those people one day." He said, "Here's the reason why old people sometimes get cranky." And he was alluding to Ecclesiastes 11 and 12, that in their youth, they didn't remember their Creator. In their youth, their beauty was their God. And then age or illness took it away from them. Or when they were young, being a football player or an athlete was their God. And then they start to get a little bit older and they can't do those things that they used to do. Or you can think of all kinds of other things that illness or even aging can take away from you. Imagine that you think that you're going to be beautiful and strong, handsome, whatever it is, the rest of your life. Illness is going to take it away from you. What about poverty? I mean, what is the media telling us to worry about right now? Oh, the price of gold and every... We're just constantly assigned things to worry about in the news, aren't we? Like, did you know you're supposed... If you turn on the news today, you'll find something else out that you didn't know you were supposed to worry about. And poverty is probably one of them. So start worrying about that. And then also the voice of duty. What's the voice of duty? Have you ever seen young people that have all these dreams of, like, really unrealistic jobs that they think are going to make them money? And then eventually you have something called a bill, and your art career is not going to pay those bills. And so you got all these things that are taking you away. All right, so let's just review, because we've talked about a lot of things. The secular approach to meaning is there is no objective meaning in life, but I get to decide my own meaning. And maybe for me it means family. Maybe for me it means education. Maybe for me it means having tonnes of fun. What are the review of the weaknesses? This can't apply to everybody, the way that our culture does this today. It's vexing to think about for people who are more deeper thinkers, and I think those kinds of thoughts crash in on everybody. And then suffering or some kind of trial is eventually going to come and strip you away from your meaning anyways. Now, so far, can you imagine walking through some of this stuff with a skeptic, a secular-minded person, and going, well, I guess I'm starting to see that my worldview is just poverty. You'd want to replace that with something else. So what is the biblical approach to having meaning in life? And if a lot of the idea of meaning stems from our origins, what are the first things that the Bible says about human beings? Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 and 27. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. What does it mean to be made in God's image? It would be helpful if maybe we took that Hebrew word for image and tried to see where else it's used in the Old Testament to maybe illustrate what's going on here. Do you know that this same Hebrew word for image is used to talk about false gods in the Promised Land? Like Numbers 33, verse 52, "You shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you and destroy all their figured stones and destroy all their metal images and demolish all their high places." So imagine that you have Baal or Molech or Dagon. And here's the statue of Dagon, the fish god. And maybe some people in the land of the Philistines also have some of these statues in their own house. If you were an Israelite and you failed to drive out all the people, and so you're starting to hang out with some of these people, and you go, "Hey, I got a question about Dagon over there." Like, yeah, what's your question about Dagon? I was hoping you'd ask. Well, that little statue that you have over there, do you think that that statue is literally Dagon? What do you think that would say? No, but it's a representation of him. It's an image of Dagon. And we'll bow down to it and pray to it as if we're doing it to the actual God. Try to imagine for a moment that we did an exercise and we said, okay, we're going to try to make an image of God. And we went around the room and somebody's like, "Well, I like to think of God like a lamb because he's so gentle." And then somebody else goes, well, I like to think of him like a bull with big horns because he's strong. And then some weird person says an octopus because they're trying to be funny or something. And people have all these fights about how are we going to represent God? You know what the problem with saying, well, he's like a lamb or he's like a bull and that's going to be the image is if you have a statue of a bull, do you know what it does? You see the point? It's just one, it's one snapshot. If you took one picture of you, just one picture, would you say that that one picture of you, that image of you, totally represents you? No. Of all the things that God made, what is the one thing that's been given the dignity to be an image of Him? Of all the things God made, what is most like God? It's human beings. It's not a stone carved image or something like that, but it's human beings that have the ability to have emotions and act and react and love and pursue virtues like what God has. We're the ones that can be the most like God, and it doesn't matter what your skin color is. And it doesn't matter how educated you are. It doesn't matter what country you're from. It doesn't matter how many limbs you have. None of those things matter. The Christian worldview, the biblical worldview, dignifies every single human being by saying, of everything God made, you're the most like God. And your mission in life is to reflect Him to the world, to be an image bearer of Him. Do you know what that means about how we tap into our meaning in life? If you don't know God and you don't draw near to God, you're not living out your meaning in life. If you're supposed to be a reflection, an image of Him, I'm supposed to understand His grace and His compassion. I'm supposed to understand how His anger works. I'm supposed to draw near to Him so that I can then look like Him and reflect that out into the world. When you see the swoosh symbol, what do you think of? Nike. Your phones, they have icons on them, which is the Greek word for image, icon. If you got an icon with the letter F on it with a blue background, that's Facebook. We know what those icons represent. When people see you, do they think NASCAR? Do they think hunting? Do they think Cybertrucks? Whatever it might be. Like, this is what my life is about. Have you ever gone to a funeral before of somebody who didn't care about the Lord and what they cared about was NASCAR? You know, good old Billy Joe. Every time those cars took that left turn, he was just into it. And we're all going to wear our NASCAR uniforms for Billy Joe's funeral, and he sure liked them cars. Isn't that sad? Can that sometimes describe Christians? I'm not picking on NASCAR. If you like that, that's good for you. But it better not be your meaning in life. That's the first thing to say about the biblical approach to meaning, is that you were created to draw near to God and then reflect that to the world so that the whole world would be filled with His glory. Here's another thing to say about the Christian approach to meaning in life. This was the scripture reading, 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 6 and 7. In this you rejoice, though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been grieved by various trials, so that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. The audience of 1 Peter is going through a lot of hardship. There's Christians that are married to non-Christians in chapter 3. Verse 6 here says that they're experiencing various trials. They've been scattered from their homeland. All throughout the book, they're being spoken against as evildoers. Do you remember one of the things that Bertrand Russell said about the secular approach to having meaning in life? Is that you might think that you're going to attain whatever you want, but by death, by illness, by poverty, by the voice of duty, there's going to be things that strip meaning away from you. So what about for the Christian? Can the Christian go through trials and difficulties and imperfect marriages and it doesn't affect your meaning in life in the sense that it's not taking you away from your meaning in life? Is it true that these Christians are actually going through grief? I remember shortly after I became a Christian, every time I would get our family had a tradition, even though it was a non-Christian family, we always had dinner together, all the time. And so every time we would have dinner together, it was always like, it's time to pummel Eric and try to help him know that the Bible's not true and that he's joined a cult. And there was one time when I was going to school the next day after a really rough dinner. And there was a religious girl at school that we had gone to some Bible studies together, and she was well-meaning but believed in some false doctrine. And we were walking into the school together, and she said, "How are you doing today?" And I said, "Honestly, I'm not doing well." And she cocked her head, and she said, "Well, every day should be rejoicing in the Lord, so what's wrong?" Have you ever had Christians where it's like, you remember Job chapter 3 when he's cursing the day of his birth? Do you think Job was like a really righteous person? Imagine the most spiritually mature Christian you know. And then imagine that person, because Job would probably still be better than whoever you're thinking. And then imagine that really spiritually mature Christian saying what Job says in Job 3. Do you feel like you'd want to maybe challenge him a little bit? You know, you better be careful not talking like that. These Christians are grieving, and we have books like Lamentations, and all. And so my point in this is not to say, yes, we can go through trials, but we still have our meaning in life, and that means that we're never going to grieve. This text says, no, you can grieve and still have rejoicing at the same time, because this meaning that we have in life, nothing is going to take it away from us. Use the imagery of the text. Think about this gold. Our faith is compared to this gold. Imagine that you had like a block of gold, like a nugget of gold, and it could talk to you. And you were like, "Hey, Mr. Gold, do you want to be refined?" And Mr. Gold says, "I sure do." And you're like, "Okay, Mr. Gold, let's bring you to the fire." And then Mr. Gold is saying, "Why are you doing that to me? This feels kind of, this is really uncomfortable." "Well, you said you wanted to be pure." You know the times in your life that you've been driven deeper into your meaning in life? You've thought more about what it means to serve the Lord. You've found more comfort in the Lord. You've drawn closer to Him. Are the times that you've suffered the most. And so for the world, you go through trials, the Twitter mob comes after you, and you lose your job, and you had all your meaning built up into these things. For the Christian, we can suffer, we can be persecuted, the economy can collapse, and it doesn't take us away from our meaning in life. That's the second thing. There's a third thing, though, and that is the good news about there being a judgment day. You remember in Ecclesiastes when Solomon is trying to figure out meaning in life and what's the point of life and all of this, and he ends the book by talking about this in Ecclesiastes 12, 13, and 14. "The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil." I think when Solomon writes this, this is kind of like a relief. He's not bringing up judgment day like, oh, doom and gloom, and it, you know, this is really bad. Instead, you know, I tried finding meaning in all these different things, and here's the conclusion. Fear God and keep His commandments, and there's going to be a judgment day. And for him, I think that's a relief. You remember when Leo Tolstoy, in the quote that we had from him, said that he could give no reason for any single action or for his whole life? What if there's a judgment day? Does that mean that you, the way that you treat the waitress right now matters? Does that mean that the way that you handle that person that just cut you off in the road matters? Does that mean that the reason you have a garden in the backyard matters? Because we're going to have to give an account for everything that we do, and if there is a judgment day, everything is now infused with meaning. If there is no judgment day, then nothing has meaning. So for the Christian worldview, judgment is a good thing. And as we're seeking to become more and more into more perfected imagers of God, look what 1 John 3, 2 says. "Beloved, we are God's children now, and what we will be has not yet appeared, but we know that when He appears, we shall be like Him, because we shall see Him as He is." There's coming a day where, for the Christian, all the things you've been pursuing of becoming more patient, becoming more loving, understanding righteous anger and unrighteous anger, and distinguishing between the two, and pursuing the things that God wants you to be so that you can reflect His image into the world, there's coming a day where all the things that you were pursuing will be perfected in you. What is the biblical approach to meaning? We're created to be images of God. Everybody has that. Suffering drives us deeper into our meaning, and it doesn't take our meaning away from us. And Judgment Day means that everything that we do matters. Now, you compare that to the secular worldview. I like to have fun. You know, I like to have a nice family and all like to do nice vacations and all that. And yeah, and every now and then I think about these things deeply, and it's quite vexing and depressing. And then Jesus would say things like, if anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. How many people do you know that are spiritually malnourished right now? How many of us have been drinking from the wrong wells? The secular approach to meaning does not provide a robust sense of what we need. But if we come to the Lord and we make our lives all about Him, we'll understand what it means to live. We're about to sing the song, Is Thy Heart Right with God? If there's anybody here tonight that's not been making God their ultimate thing, you've not been living for the purpose that you were created. If we can do anything for you tonight, the Bible teaches that you become a Christian by repenting and being baptized into Christ for the remission of your sins. If you've done that at some point and God has no longer been your greatest pursuit, do not leave here without talking to somebody. If there's anything we can do, you can even come forward now while we stand and while we sing.